You're now in the huddle with Coach Calls Timeout, the podcast that dissects the mind of a different basketball coach every episode. We uncover what makes them successful and how their story translates to your coaching journey. Let's unlock your team's potential together. Welcome to episode 25 of the Coach Calls Timeout podcast. Dan Jonker here. Today we're taking a dive into the world of data analytics. We have Denny Beausoleil on the show to share his coaching journey and how he got wrapped up into the world of basketball data. He's actually able to give you a scouting report on a team without even watching them play. In our interview today, we're going to find out the best stats that show player and team efficiency. We also talk about if you're going to look at just three stats, which three are the best to improve your efficiency and enhance your chances of success. As usual, stick around after the interview because we have a great story from Coach Steve Konchalski in the latest installment of Storytime with the Canadian Coach K. My brother Brian handles the interview with Denny Beausoleil. Let's get to it.
Brian Jonker here with episode 25 of the Coach Calls Timeout podcast. And today we have with us Denny Beausoleil. Denny has coached at most recently at Douglas College, but is right now taking some time out to expand his interest in basketball analytics. And today we're going to explore something we haven't talked about in the previous 24 podcasts. And that's kind of a deep dive into numbers and statistics and which ones are good and which ones are bad and which ones are meaningful and which ones aren't. And the different types of things that can help a basketball coach when evaluating what his how his team is performing. So, Denny, we really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule today to join me.
Thanks for having me on the pod.
So let's start first with your background. So how did you get into coaching, first of all?
I think it was something that was just a path that I was probably going to do anyway since my childhood. My dad coached basketball for 30 years in Ontario. I'm from St. Thomas, Ontario, which is just outside of London. And growing up through university, I just realized that I really wanted to be a coach, and I thought it'd be a good career to do. It'd be something that I would enjoy doing. So while I was a student at Queen's University, when I was doing my undergrad, I approached the coach there at the time, Chris Oliver, who's now at Windsor, and asked him if I could come to practices and listen and learn and just kind of get a sense of what it's like to be a coach, because I had no experience previous to that. And that was the start of my journey.
And tell us about how you got from Queens all the way out to British Columbia.
So it's actually also to do with Chris Oliver. When I was at Queens and talking to him about being a coach and such, he said, you know, there's two things. Like, you're going to need to get some sort of education if you want to coach at an institution, because they're going to need to hire someone with some sort of background, some sort of education. The other thing was he mentioned that there was a master's program at UVic and a National Coaching Institute in Victoria. So I was in Kingston doing my undergrad in geology at Queens and finished that. And when I was done my geology degree, I applied and moved over to Victoria and did the master's in coaching education there. And I also did the National Coaching Institute at the same time. So I was in Victoria for about 3 years. After Victoria, I was planning on staying with UVic, coaching with Craig Bocamp and, you know, working different club teams and things like that. And I had a good situation going there, but I had an opportunity to work full-time as a teacher at Douglas College. They offered me a full-time teaching job, so I took it. And it gave me the financial freedom to pursue coaching, because, you know, in Canada, it's hard to get a full-time head coaching position. Like, how many jobs are there out there? So I took the full-time teaching job, and luckily when I got here, coaching job was open as well. I applied for it in my first year, didn't get it. It went to Clay Pottinger, who's at
Red Deer.
Yeah, who's at Red Deer.
Yeah.
And Clay and I knew each other a little bit. He was from U of A, I was from UVic. And when he heard that I applied for the job as well and didn't get it, he messaged me right away and said, you know, I'd love for you to come be my assistant. So I said yes, and I helped him for a year. And then when he only stayed at Douglas for one season, and when he left, the athletic director promoted me to the head coach, and I did that for 5 years. So 1 year assistant and 5 years head coach. And then this last year, I just gave it up for, like as you said, to try to pursue this data analyst stuff.
Yeah. So let's start into that then. Where does your love of numbers come from, and and why lean towards the analytics versus the actual coaching?
I never thought that analytics was going to be something. It was something that I was kind of just interested in. I didn't think it was going to be a career. But when I was at UVic doing my master's, everyone has to do a project or a thesis. And I approached the supervisor and I said, you know, I would really like to do it on data analytics to analyze team performance. And he said, sure. And I was really surprised that he said yes, that I could do it, to give me that sort of freedom to pursue my own topic. And so I just started working on a team performance analysis statistic that I came up with on my own. And it just kind of spawned over the years. I started paying attention to different data analysts out there in the NBA or college or various writers that were writing about basketball analytics. And I paid attention to it to see what was out there in the world. And when I was over at Douglas College coaching, I started implementing a lot of the analytics with my own team just to use it as a competitive advantage, just to see if it would help. So I would track various statistics. It just kind of spawned from there. It was more organic, I guess, in terms of like an interest sparked with me during my master's. And then I just kept using the data to help my own coaching.
And you must have at least had a kind of a head or an interest for numbers, you know, growing up as well. Like
a little bit. I mean, I do like math, and I work on Excel pretty much every single day. But yeah, it was more just to me. Analytics is more about telling a story, understanding relationships, and explaining. And it is not nearly as much about the numbers or the formulas or how to manipulate, like, or how to look at numbers. I mean, it's more about like how does one statistic relate to another? What is the meaning of it? And it's something that I approached from a useful perspective instead of just a numerical.
Right now, what types of work, or who would you do work for? Let's not necessarily dive into the actual analytics yet, but the type of jobs that are available for this type of thing, and the type of interest that is now being sparked in basketball, and where could this type of thing go?
Basically, every NBA team has a full-time data analyst, and the best NBA teams hire a data analyst and at least one other data scientist. So by data scientist, I mean a programmer, someone that can actually take the raw data, can aggregate huge volumes of data, and then turn it into something useful for an analyst. So there's those sorts of jobs out there. You could also work for companies or for industry. And then you call it, like, there's also, you know, national teams and things like that. So it's usually high level. There is a little bit at the university level where teams are willing to pay to have a data analyst, but it's not really that many people. So right now it's mostly just at the professional level. But personally, I do get approached from some universities and colleges to work as a consultant to look at their data. So there are some sort of university college level as well, but most of the jobs are professional. And the problem with that is that from an amateur's perspective, is that the people that are doing really good data analytic work, they're working for professional teams, and then their work isn't public anymore. So no one knows what sort of work is going on out there unless you're already in that world.
Right. Well, and I would imagine, though, that the trickle down will eventually be, say, places like the NCAA. There's 360-something Division I teams right now. I got to imagine... Mm-hmm. There'll be a bunch of them that will slowly come aboard here and start having those types of people on staff as well.
Yeah, I know. I do know of a few people who work as data analysts for Division I programs, but I don't know if they're. I don't know how many people are full time. It seems to be an industry that is mostly contract or consulting sort of work, and with a few jobs that are full time, and those are really highly sought after and highly contested.
So now that we've got a little bit of your background and we've got a little bit of maybe what the potential is out there for people like yourself, mm-hmm. let's do the real complicated thing here and try and get into the numbers part of it and how it relates at a high enough level that it'll interest the people who are actually numbers and analytics type people versus getting too high level where we're going to have everybody else hit the off button right now or shut off their podcast that don't want anything to do with numbers or are going to reject any analytics talk that is currently happening more and more and day to day in everybody's sporting world. So that I think is a challenge. But I personally, my teams, this is my 12th year at Mohawk College. Mm-hmm. Right from day one, I've more than embraced the 3-point shot. And I believe that mm-hmm. there's a math equation in here. And, you know, shooting 60% from three or from two is the same as shooting 40% from three.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Your rebounding percentages and opportunities of shooting threes off the fast break, I think you're probably your offensive rebounding goes up. There's a mm-hmm. lot of things that factor into saying that the 3-point shot, for example, is, you know, a successful way to play. Mm-hmm. What types of things do you look at or what measures do you think are the best to determining what a good team is?
So for me, looking at how good a team is, like if I want to look at just one number to determine how good a team is, I look at their points per possession on offense, subtract the points per possession on defense. And I write about that in Canadian Hoops Talk, but I personally think that that is the best measure. There's, you know, if you wanted to just look at point differential, that's also pretty good as well. So point differential is not too bad, but it doesn't take into account certain things like pace of play, whereas points per possession does take into account things like pace of play as well as other things. So I personally like points per possession. That's why I write about it. That's why I talk mostly about it. But it also kind of stems when you mentioned about the 3-point line. If you talk about where shots are taken in the half court, points per possession are a very easy thing to discuss when discussing shot location. So if it's a 2-point jump shot versus a layup, versus a 3-point shot, they can all be talked about in terms of points per possession. In Canada, the average offensive points per possession is 1.00, somewhere around there.
When you say in Canada, what like are you talking the U Sport? Are you talking?
Yeah, so 1.00 is U Sport, and then in the Pac West, anyway, it's been around 0.95, 0.96. Every level that you increase, or every level you go up, the points per possession gets a little higher. So in the NBA, it's around 1.065. And it goes up from the CCAA to U Sport to NCAA to, NBA. NBA being the highest.
And that's consistent, eh? Like that. Yep. Okay.
Yeah. So, but, you know, as athletes get older, they just get better. They get better at shooting and scoring. And so, therefore, the points per possession goes up. But even though the defense is improving, the offense improves at a faster rate.
And but at the CCAA, the U Sport, the NCAA, the athletes are all relatively the same age. But obviously, mm-hmm. the perception maybe is actually the reality that the levels of each of those sports probably are in the same order as your points per possession would say.
Yeah, it is pretty close. It isn't that close. It's close a lot with the average, but on the ends, it isn't that close. Whereas in the NBA, there's less, like if you know what a bell curve, like the average teams are in the middle with the worst teams at the very end, and there's very few bad teams and the best teams at the very top, and there's very few good teams. In the NBA, the bell curve is really, really narrow. It's really shrunken and small. So there isn't that much of a difference between the best teams and the worst teams. Whereas in U Sport, there is a very large difference. I think it's probably because in the NBA, there's more games, more teams play each other, and it's just, this competition level is generally better across the board. So it's just harder to be that much better than your opponents and have to be statistically that much better. So that's probably why the deviation is smaller in the NBA.
This is going to be a very general question, but I don't know if you'll have an answer for it. If you were coaching, let's just say some youth team, And without actually looking at the personnel of the team, in an ideal world, is there a style of play or a mathematical equation that you'd offer that would say this would give you, you know, your best chance for success just from a number standpoint?
I would probably do one of two things. So I do consult with Canada Basketball, and I worked with our U15 national team, even at that level as well, even at the national team level, but this applies to high school as well. I would look at one of two things. I would either look at your relative athleticism compared to your opposition, or, and if you're more athletic, then I would press, and I would look to try to get a high tempo turnovers and fast break layups, because fast break layups are always going to be, regardless of skill, fast break layups are always going to give you your largest return on investment. And then the next best way to score is free throws. So if you can create turnovers, get runouts, get layups, and then attack the offensive glass or just drive to the rim a lot and try to draw fouls and shoot free throws, that'll be your best bang for your buck if you're really athletic. And then if you're not athletic, or if you're about as average as the rest of your opponents out there, then I would look at playing a pace of play that is suitable to your team. So if you need to slow it down, then that would be one way to try to give yourself the biggest advantage, because by slowing the pace of play down, there's just less possessions, and therefore there's going to be less of a chance of the opposition blowing you out. So, but it really depends on how good your team is and how athletic it is anyway. And then from there, start to come up with a style of play.
You work with teams now. Do you just look at raw data, or do you have to see the individuals? I mean, last year I sat with Avneet, the assistant coach at VIU, and we've had him on a podcast before as well. But I sat with him at Nationals last year, and I was fascinated that you had done work for them and basically outlined the different strengths and weaknesses of certain opponents they had in the players just by looking at the numbers.
I didn't know that Av told you that. So Av and I are very close friends.
Yeah.
Yes. He's a dear friend of mine. And I know that when you had him on the podcast, I emailed you saying that I was happy you had him, because him and I have known each other for a long time. He's one of the first coaches I met when I moved to the island. And he kind of reminds me of myself a little bit. He's about 10 years younger than me, and he has a very similar personality to me. So, but yeah, my Douglas College teams over the years, we were average, usually average every single year. But Avni's teams, VIU, has been attending Nationals. So he would ask me, him and Kuzminski would ask me, hey, could you look at the data for our opponents? So I would just look at box score data, break it down, and then send them an email attachment that had their strengths and weaknesses and what their play style was like just by looking at the box score. So,
him and I discussed it at length one night.
Yeah.
And man, the stuff you came up with was bang on. And I'm like, so like he's watching video, he's doing it.
Yeah.
No, he's just looking at numbers.
Yeah. It's like, just box score. I didn't watch 1 second of tape and I could get all that stuff. But like if you're, the box score data is actually not that bad if it's collected properly.
Right.
And, you can get some pretty good stuff. You can tell. So, from the box score, I can tell not only if a person, like obviously if someone shoots a lot of threes, then they're a shooter, like that makes sense. If they grab a lot of offensive rebounds, then they're an offensive rebounder, et cetera, et cetera. If they're lots of steals, lots of blocks, you can kind of tell that just traditionally looking at box scores. But one of the things that I do is I take all of the box scores for an entire league, aggregate them all into one spreadsheet, and then I turn the data into efficiency data. And then from there, I can see who actually is the very best in terms of three-point shooting, or who can get to the rim versus who takes a pull-up jump shot. So it maybe doesn't make sense just thinking about it, but by looking at a box score, you can tell if someone drives to get to the rim or if they drive to pull up and take a jump shot just by looking at box score data.
Yeah, and again, I mean, we had done film work on some of the teams that we were potentially going to play.
Yeah.
So by the time Avneet and I had that discussion, we had already been beaten out by Nate the night before.
Yeah.
But when we started talking about it, it fascinated me more and more, because we were talking about players and faces that I could recognize. And through my film study, when he's saying, well, this guy does this, and that guy does this, and that guy can do this, and that guy does. And by that time, Avneet had also done film work. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, like it's, we don't need to watch film. We just need Denny to look at the data and send it to us. Like, I was impressed. I was impressed.
Well, thanks. I mean, the data for me is something that is pointed my eye in the direction. So when I take, like, now that I'm not coaching college level, I break down more data and then I can watch more tape. And that is really good I break down the data and then I know what to watch for. And it points my eye in a much faster direction. And I can, instead of watching lots of tape, I can get a sense just from box score data and then have my eye confirm it, because data is only as meaningful if you understand how to apply it and how it makes sense. And I think that's one of the things that, one of the reasons why I've been able to get a footing in this data analytics world so quickly is because I am a coach. First and foremost, you know, I never considered being a data analyst. I have always considered trying to be a coach first, and the analytics has grown naturally from it. So to take the data and then turn it into something meaningful from a coach's perspective has really been an advantage, I think.
After you make some suggestions to people after looking at data, do you actually go back and reevaluate what they're doing just out of curiosity, or actually because they asked you to again? Or do you chart the progress of the things that you've offered to people?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I'll tell you some stories, but, so there's one team I'm helping right now, and, I'm tracking the data with them the whole season long worth of data and making suggestions to the coaching staff about who to play and who not to play, who to play together and who to avoid playing together. So should you play this two-man big man rotation, or should it be a one-man big man, or, you know, which combos of guards should be played together?
Is that based solely on the numbers or also with film?
No, that is solely on numbers. So I myself and another member of the team, we track all of our own proprietary data for lineups and individuals. So we'll actually watch the game tape or sit on the bench and track the data by hand as it's going on. Just lineup efficiency. And then from there, I take it, aggregate it, and turn it into lineup efficiency. So I'll give you an example with my Douglas College team. There was one year that we had a pretty good team, and I tracked which lineups were going to be the most efficient versus the least efficient. And I tracked it for the whole season long, preseason, regular season, out of conference play, etc. As the season was going on, I was getting more and more and more data, and it was starting to affect which players I would play together. I knew that one big man had to play with another, or these two guards shouldn't play together, etc. And I ended up coming up with an idea of who to play together, you know, who to sub in together and play as units. And we had never beaten VIU. This is Avenue's team. And we'd never beaten VIU that year. We were 0-3 in the regular season, but we were always very close. I think we took them to overtime once, and it was a buzzer beater another time or something. So it was some pretty close games. But we met them in the semifinal. And at that point, because I finally had enough season-long data, that we only played lineups that were a positive points per possession. And we completely avoided the negative points per possession lineups.
And how do you manage that in the course of a game?
I just knew who to play together. After doing it, because I collected the data myself and then implemented myself. So it was very easy to remember. Because you know who you're subbing in and who not to sub out, like who not to sub in together. It was really more like, by collecting the data, I knew who not to play together. It was probably a better way of explaining it.
Okay.
There was one player on our team that just, he wasn't an effective center. But when I played him as power forward, it was a lot better. And there was another person as well who was actually really, really good as a two-man, even though I thought he was a three. And then the lineup data sorted that out for me. So once I started to get a better idea of who to play at what positions, we were beating VIU for most of the semifinal game, and we ended up losing the game. VIU beat us in the last minute or so, and then went to nationals. But, you know, I was looking at the other coaches, like, I can't believe that we're going to moneyball our way to a national tournament. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, you know, we were a good team, but it was my first year ever collecting this sort of lineup data. So I was really excited that it was actually paying out this fruitfully. So So yeah, that really made an impression on me personally. So I'm doing that same thing now. Like that would be any team that I consult with, that is the data that I suggest the team should do, because it's not that hard to collect. Anybody can collect it as long as they're trained for, you know, it takes one game of training.
And how many people actually seek out your services, you provide the information, and then they don't use it?
It's happened. It's frustrating too, because you know how some university teams or college teams message me and ask me to do some work on their team, and I'll break down their individual play or their team style, or and then I'll make suggestions on who to play together, what sort of rotation they should have, and tell them all the reasons why it would be beneficial, and then all the reasons of why it's going to hurt their chances of winning if they continue to play as they are. And then some teams just don't listen to my advice, and there's nothing I can really do, but I mean, it is just one opinion after all. Like, you know, I'm trying to give them an alternative perspective, and some people listen and some people don't. The people that don't really listen, I don't really know what to do. Like, I'll keep happily doing the work because I really enjoy it. But, you know, if you do this work, it seems so clear cut and so meaningful that someone would listen. But yeah, they don't always listen. I guess the challenge is with being a data analyst, the hardest thing is be able to explain to someone why it's important. It's not being a good mathematician. That is not that important. What's more important is being able to explain and argue your point of view.
I think too that it's still, I mean, analytics is the buzz in sports over the last couple of years, and mm-hmm. you know, the snowball's growing, but it's still kind of, you know, there's a lot of coaches out there, the majority of whom are being dragged into this, and you can get all the numbers and all the suggestions that you want, but it still is hard for people to change. I mean, and mm-hmm. I think, you know, we're getting to a point where younger generations are just going to be more acceptant of it. And mm-hmm. it probably will open up a whole new spectrum of more analytics and more positions and more jobs. But it's still kind of in its infancy, really.
Yeah. And people, if they don't know it, then they don't feel comfortable with it. It's too bad, because I think it's actually kind of a few things. This is my point of view, is that you have someone who's a really good analyst that helps the team, and they're so helpful and so useful that they start to get really well known in the community. And, you know, teams are saying, you know, I can't believe we've hired this data analyst. They're great. They're helping us out so much, blah, blah, blah. And then another team says, okay, well, we should get a data analyst. And then they hire someone who's not as good, and they look at it and go, this isn't that helpful. I don't know why we used it. I don't see the hype. But I think a lot of data analysts, from what I've heard from coaches and what I've seen, is a lot of data analysts are lazy, and that they don't do a great job of explaining. They just present the data and say, here you go, here's the data.
Right.
You know, do what you want with it. Like, this is my result. Do what you want with the data. And coaches don't want that. They don't want to be just handed results.
Yeah, I suppose the best people in your positions are going to mm-hmm. be the ones who end up also being quality teachers or coaches.
Like, a lot of good analysts are teachers.
Yeah, because how do you, I mean, if you just throw a bunch of numbers at somebody who's not necessarily a numbers guy and say, here, figure it out yourself.
Or
not to be able to explain your rationale behind the numbers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see why that would be a little bit frustrating. But if you have a coach's background or you have a teaching background mm-hmm. and are able to communicate the message better, like anything else, I think you have a better chance to be successful in working with those people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the push now with analysts is to say to people that are interested in doing it is you really have to know the sport. Whatever you're doing, whatever sport you're analyzing, you really need to understand the concepts and the principles first. And then when you find the data, then you can start to make it meaningful. And that's when you become a really good analyst. And that's one of the reasons why I write for Canadian Hoops Talk and post my stuff on there, because I want to be better at explaining things, and I find writing helps a lot. Like, every analyst has said to me, you need to write more. You need to read more, and you need to write more, because you just need to practice. You know, it's not, you're going to improve a lot better, a lot faster as an analyst if you are constantly writing and explaining. And that's one of the reasons why I started just posting things on that chat board, because it was an outlet for me to improve. And I'm happy people are liking it.
They are. I read it as well. And yeah, you see the comments and people do appreciate it. So There's a following in a wave for it.
Yep.
A couple other topics here before I let you go. Number one, how about traditionally, what are the traditional statistics that still garner merit and are important?
If you look at any box score, I do this as well when I look at when I coach, and I look at the box score and I look at offensive rebounds, the difference in offensive rebounds, the difference in turnovers, and the amount of free throws taken. That's mostly what I look at, is the offensive rebounding, the turnovers, and the free throws taken. And then I also look at, in the Pac West, I'm not sure about what it is in U Sport or OCAA, but we actually have a points per possession statistic on our page. Do you guys have that in yours too?
We do.
Okay, so I look at that as well. So I look at that number first and just get an overall idea of what that number is, because like I said, in Canada, in OCAA or in the CCAA, it should be around 0.95 on average. And so I look at that number first just to see how well both teams are scoring. And then I look at those other just very traditional metrics, just the offensive rebounds, turnovers, and free throws, because the offensive rebounds and the turnovers are going to tell you how many more possessions the team has. So they just have more chances to shoot and therefore have more chances to score. And then the free throws, just because free throws are so efficient, free throws are way too efficient. It's the most ridiculously overpowered way of scoring in the game of basketball. There's nothing else aside from fast break layups, which, I mean, how do you design an offense to create a fast break layup? Like, that's a really hard thing to do. But you can at least have an idea on how to create penetration or to create contact to get to the free throw line with your offense. And shooting free throws is such a good way of scoring that that's why I look at it. And I think traditionally as well, coaches look at free throws as well anyway. Like, even someone who is more of a traditional coach that doesn't understand analytics, I think they would look at that because they want to know how much their team is fouling, and that's an important thing as well.
Yeah, and without actually knowing, you know, the emphasis on those types of numbers, mm-hmm. might exclude this year's team that I have. We've had a rough year this year, a little bit of a rebuilding, but the mm-hmm. previous 5 years to this, we've been nationally ranked in the top five pretty much for five straight years, mm-hmm. and we have always been in the top two or three in the OCAA, 22 teams in offensive rebounding, and we've mm-hmm. been in the top two or three every year in free throws attempted.
Right.
We also have had high turnovers, but we play at an extremely high pace, so the other team also, you're talking turnover margin now, so we're mm-hmm. we're not that bad there. So without even, I mean, you probably could have looked at our numbers and predicted that, well, that team's done well over the last, you know, whatever time yeah. period. So
yeah, there are some really good, there are very good traditional statistics to look at, like the offensive rebounding and turnovers, so. And that would be a good place to start for someone who is wanting to use numbers a little bit more. That would be a place to start, at least.
All right, now let's talk about the bone of contention now in, I believe, the Pac West,
yes.
and the OUA in particular, yeah. and that's the dreaded RPI. So,
oh God.
can you give a brief Cole's Notes version on what RPI is and what your mm-hmm. opinion is and mm-hmm. and how it's affecting national championship might play out, or at least the participants at the national championship?
So RPI was developed by the NCAA selection committee as a way of mathematically analyzing teams and putting them into categories, determining how good they are. One of the issues that the NCAA selection committee had is that they weren't actually sure the best teams from mid-majors were, because they weren't necessarily playing the best competition. So they created RPI, and RPI is this. The numbers they calculate are this. It takes into account your winning percentage. It takes into account the winning percentage of your opponents. And then it takes into account the winning percentage of all the opponents that your opponents have played. So it looks just at those three metrics. Now it weighs 50% of the statistic is on your opponent's winning percentage. And 25% of the statistic is weighed on your opponent's winning percentage. So there's only a quarter of the statistic that is directly that is your own winning percentage. So the idea was this. you are going to have to play. The suction Kenny was saying this to their to the teams in NCAA. You need to play very good teams. You need to play teams that are winning, because if you play bad teams, therefore 75% of your statistic of RPI is going to go down. Your RPI is going to go down because 75% of your statistic is calculated based on these weak opponents. Conversely, if you play good opponents, then 75% of your statistic is going to be calculated based on having strong opponents. So you could actually schedule very good opponents and lose, and your RPI will go up. And the reason why the selection committee did this is that they wanted to see the best teams playing the other best teams in the season, or at least in out-of-conference play. And they wanted to see what the result was, and they also wanted to see who was winning. And that way that they could figure out a much better way of analyzing and putting teams into pools.
And how is it now affecting the PacWest and the OUA?
Yeah, the Can West.
Can West, I apologize.
Yeah, so the reason why the NCAA used it is that because in the NCAA, teams have a choice in their out-of-conference opponents, and those out-of-conference opponents affect their RPI. But in Canada, RPI is calculated based off of the regular season, and that's just given to you. The league just tells you who you're going to play. So we're using a statistic that rewards you choosing to play better opponents and punishes you for choosing to play bad opponents. And we're using that statistic where teams have no choice. They don't have a choice in who their opponents are. They're just told who their opponents are. Like UBC this year is playing a weaker schedule. It's just because the Canada West said, okay, this is what your schedule is going to be. And then they adopted RPI, which RPI is, I personally do not like RPI, but it's not necessarily the worst statistic out there. It just doesn't make sense when there is no choice. It makes a lot more sense in the NCAA when teams can choose their opponents and therefore actively influence their own RPI. So that's the reason why I don't like it, is that we're using a statistic that isn't designed for the Canadian system.
Well, and in the OUA in particular, where you have four team divisions,
and
this year Nipissing and Laurentian have done well against out of division games as well. They've done very well, but they also have the fortune, good fortune, except for the four games they play against them, of being with Carleton and Ottawa, who traditionally over, you know, a number of years now have been ridiculously strong. So like you said, by playing their four games against those two teams, regardless of the fact that they lose them, they're still actually further ahead.
Exactly. And it's just because, and that's just the OUA schedule. Like the OU just says, okay, this is the teams you're going to play. And using RPI, like if I was a coach at Nipissing or Laurentian, I'd be ecstatic.
Yeah.
Because you're getting a boosted RPI. Like you look like a much better team in terms of RPI than maybe what you actually are. So I think RPI, I think it could either be adjusted if it's going to be kept, because even NCAA has adjusted RPI as well. Like there was a period of time in the early 2000s where the NCAA selection committee, they were publicly producing RPI, but they were privately using their own adjusted RPI for the selection process. They weren't actually using the publicly announced metric. They have since changed that. They've since now publicly stated what they're doing with how they changed their RPI, but they've changed their calculation over the years as well. It's not quite the same when it was first introduced. So I think in Canada, if it wants to be kept, it can just be adjusted and give more weighting to your own winning percentage, because that's one way teams can actually, you want to reward teams for playing well, right? Like this is something that should just sit well with people. Like if you want to reward effort and you want to reward people for playing well, and the RPI isn't rewarding you for that right now, not its current formula.
Hey, it's Dan here. I just want to jump in real quick. Here at Coach Calls Timeout, we're a basketball coaching resource. If you're a coach and you need a few plays or drills, check us out at coachcallstimeout.com. We have something that nobody else does. All our plays and drills are in video format, no still shots, and they can be downloaded directly to your laptop, phone, or tablet. All the videos are small enough files that you can send them to your players to use as a study guide or use them during practices or timeouts. As a podcast listener, you can take advantage of our special offer. Go to coachcallstimeout.com right after this episode And when you're signing up to become a member, just use the coupon code PODCAST, and you'll receive a free 7-day trial to sample everything we have to offer. Now let's get back to the interview with Denny Beausoleil.
We always end up every episode with a little bit of a full court press.
Yeah.
And we ask some questions of you. So I'd like to throw a few quick ones at you if I can to end today.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So first of all, do you prefer watching the NCAA or the NBA?
NBA.
As an analytics person, whose work you currently most admire?
Well, I like Zach Lowe as a writer. I think he's really good. And he's been someone that's influenced me. He works for ESPN. He's a public figure. But I do know someone, I do know the data analyst for the 76ers. He actually lives here in Vancouver. And he's been somewhat of a mentor, and I really like how he explains things so clearly.
Favorite player to currently watch based solely on analytics? Who's an efficient guy in your mind?
I do like Steph Curry, honestly, even from an analytics perspective. I think one of the reasons why someone like maybe like DeMar DeRozan, people maybe don't necessarily understand his game, even though he doesn't shoot a lot of threes and he does shoot long twos instead. He actually does have an efficient game as well. And his game's kind of grown on me. I used to not really love it that much, but once I started to understand the analytics of the game, I started to appreciate it more. But I'd like the guys that can score the rim and shoot threes. That's my kind of player.
And true to form as an analytics guy, we're looking for one-word answers, and you give me 6 sentences. What about a favorite team to watch from an analytics standpoint?
Spurs.
Can you watch a game as a fan, or are you always thinking about the numbers?
Oh, I can watch a game as a fan, yeah. I can turn it on or off, but it does bug me, though, when teams aren't playing efficiently.
And finally, ultimate job for you in basketball, what would it be?
I would like to work for an NBA team as a data analyst.
All right. Fantastic. Denny, yeah. I really appreciate the time that you spent today. And like I said, hopefully we can get together again sometime and talk a little bit more.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me on.
There you have it. There's no doubt that data analytics can enhance your team's performance. Even if you aren't fortunate enough to have a team of people helping you out to take stats, you can pay attention to 3 things to make your team more efficient: offensive rebounding, low turnovers, and get to the foul line. Give yourself a better chance to win games by getting more possessions. This is all stuff that can be practiced, and the emphasis on it can be taught. We're always encouraging coaches to keep learning. This is a great thing you can learn more about. The information is becoming more available with each passing season. Did this episode remind you of a coach you've had or a basketball experience you've shared with someone? If so, we'd love to hear about it. You can go to coachcallstimeout.com/stories to share your story. We're looking for stories about coaches who are creating fantastic memories for their players. Help give them the recognition they deserve and possibly get their story told on this podcast. Again, you can go to coachcallstimeout.com/stories to share your story. If you enjoyed what you heard, we'd appreciate it if you could rate us on iTunes or tell someone else about the show. Everything we've talked about today can be found in our show notes at coachcallstimeout.com/25. We'll be back again in 2 weeks to pick the brain of another great coach. But before we go, if you listened to episode 20 with Coach Steve Konchalski, you know that he's a Hall of Fame basketball coach who's been coaching for over 40 years. In that episode, he shares some great stories. And he has so many stories that we made it a segment on the show. Here's story time with the Canadian Coach K. Enjoy.
Well, I think some of your listeners might be interested to kind of hear how a little bit of CIS, or I should say U Sports, basketball history developed. And I'm going to go back into the early 70s and talk about the fact that, you know, this was pre-shot clock time, and this was also pre-restrictions on international players coming into Canada. And this all happened in the early 70s when St. Mary's University, and there were some other universities across the country as well that were recruiting predominantly American players. It came to a head when St. Mary's, I believe it was 1973, won the at that time CIAU national championship with 11 Americans and one Canadian. And one Canadian was a good player, by the way, by the name of Willie Follette. Anyhow, as a reaction to that, the CIAU put a restriction in, basically aimed at American players. In that same, limited them to three. In that same year, St. Mary's, it might have been the next year, St. Mary's came back to University of Waterloo, who had been hosting on and off the national tournament, as they had one of the best gyms in the country, probably still do. St. Mary's opened up with the University of Waterloo, and they were ranked in the top two or three in the country, respectively. And the night before they were to meet, I had dinner with Brian Heaney, who was the coach at St. Mary's at the time, former teammate of mine who went on to play in the NBA with the old Baltimore Bullets. And Heaney said, the fans of Waterloo traditionally, and I don't know if they still do this, stand up and they cheer and they don't sit down until Waterloo has scored their first bucket. So he said, I'm going to really tick them off. And he said, what do you think of this? I'm going to hold the ball. So I just said, and again, this is pre-shot clock. And I just said, Brian, why would you do that? I mean, your team's just as good, maybe better. You're not the same class or team. He said, oh, that's what I want to do. Anyway, he did it. He held the ball for, 8 or 10 minutes. I don't believe he won the game, actually. So the strategy didn't necessarily work, but what it did do was motivate the coaches in the country to vote to put a shot clock in. And so there's a little bit of history on two significant rules that we have in Canadian university basketball and how they came to be. And a lot of it was because of the St. Mary's initiative. Going forward, following up on this so-called American rule, which is what they used to call it, there was 1 year, that was 1978-79, where there was a 1 year gap where you were allowed to bring in American players without them having to sit out a year, and they could have exhausted their eligibility in the U.S. and come up and play the fifth year in Canada and not have to sit out. But at that time, actually, nobody had to sit out. You could switch from one university to another in Canada and play four teams in 4 years or five teams in 5 years without having to sit out. But for 1 year, and that was that 1 year, and the Atlantic Conference went out and got players from several of the major D1 schools in the eastern United States. We picked up a 6'9" center from Long Island University, starting center from Long Island University of New York. Katie had Victor Suarez, 6'8" center from the University of Rhode Island. And we all had players of that kind of a caliber. And just to give you an idea, now we all know that Carleton is competing at a high level with D1 teams. And I think they went undefeated this year in the month of August against D1 teams. But this was back in 1978-79, where my St. Evex team, Boston College came up and played us at St. Evex, and we blew them out of the gym on American Thanksgiving Day. We went down to Virginia, and the first night we beat the University of Richmond. The second night, we went and played Virginia Tech, ranked number 20 in the U.S. And I called one of my coaching friends in the States, and I said, how should we play? This is before, all the video and being able to see teams play and get all this information. How should we play these guys? And Pete Gillen, who went out to coach at Xavier and Providence, whatever, and Pete said, you're going to have to hold the ball. You can't play with them. Anyway, with 2 minutes to go in the game, we were down 4, and they held the ball the last 6 minutes on us. Our third game, we went down 2, and we ended up losing by 6. And then our third game, in 3 nights, we went to play James Madison University, and the game went into overtime, and they held the ball the whole overtime for 5 minutes of the overtime and made a buzzer shot to beat us. So that was the caliber of play back in those days. And I think, you know, certainly the rule that that's been in existence since then has really helped Canadian college basketball, develop Canadian players, given Canadian players an opportunity to play, especially back in those days when other teams, certain teams in the country were not, you know, recruiting Canadians. They were, you know, insisting on competing with American players. But it certainly was a high caliber play, and it gives you a little bit of a history of the background of how some of these rules that are, you know, how they evolved and why they evolved.